Hello, my name's Tina Quinn and you're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. This week, we're bringing you a very special in conversation with one of Australia's most accomplished foreign correspondents, the great Philip Williams. This week, he finishes up a very eventful 46 years in broadcast. Phil started work at the ABC in Canberra in 1975 as a stagehand before moving into news. His illustrious career has included time spent as the 7:30 Report's Canberra reporter, an extensive stint travelling rural Australia with the program Countrywide, and he was also one of Australian Story's founding producers. However, it's Phil's work as a foreign correspondent for which he has become best known. His very first posting was to Tokyo, Japan in 1990, and he's since gone on to bring some of the world's biggest events into the living rooms of many Australians. September 11th in the US, the ensuing war in Iraq, the Arab Spring, the Beslan school siege, London's Grenfell Tower fire, where he filmed a whole 7:30 story on with his mobile phone, Brexit, the rise of Donald Trump, natural disasters across Asia and the Pacific, North America and Europe. Phil's done it all. For the last 4.5 years, he's been the ABC's chief foreign correspondent, a role that was created specifically for him. And on the eve of his retirement, he has very kindly agreed to join us here in studio. Phil Williams, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thanks very much.
Now, Phil, your career has been 46 years long, 40 of those years at the ABC. You started working for the public broadcaster in 1975 in Canberra. Well, what a year to show up in Canberra. 75 was a very turbulent year for Australia with the dismissal of the Whitlam government. Tell us about your experiences back then and also what the ABC was like in 1975. I imagine it was a very different place.
It's a different planet, in fact. You know, 1975. You had people either slotted into radio or TV. You didn't do both. You didn't cross over. Within radio, you had radio news people. That was their job. You had radio current affairs people. That was their job. So there's not the fluid nature of exchange of people's roles and whatever. And you didn't have to do, you know, 150 different things each day, which you now have to do. So it's actually harder being a journalist these days, I think. In some respects, easier in the sense that you have the full resources of the net to quickly reach. You know, you wanted to know something back then, you literally had to go to the library to find something else. Maybe the parliamentary library, which is where I worked in Canberra, of course. Mm-hmm. But you didn't have those ready sources of information. So that's where the old buggers really came in. You know, the people you worked with, they could tell you the stories. They could give you the backstories. And they could fill you in on that sort of thing. And suddenly, at 64, I find myself the old bugger. So I feel a certain sense of obligation to try and give back. That's what I tried to do over time. And, I have received as much as I've given from the young people because there's such a brilliant, talented young cohort of people coming through, especially at the ABC.
And who were some of the old buggers that in your day that sort of gave back to you in a sense?
Oh, gosh. You know what? I keep getting asked this, you know, specific names and whatever, and I don't like to do that because I'll forget somebody, and you know, people that are important and significant, I'll leave them out and offend them, and you know,
of course.
So I don't like to do that. But look, as you go on in your career, you are the product of those that have gone before you. Those that have gone before you have established the rules, the framework, the philosophy, the do's and don'ts. And that's very important, you know, that you should be quite sort of respect those that have gone before you because, you know, you may not have enormous regard for them at a personal level or you may not love all of their journalism, but they are part of that, the continuity of Australian journalism of which you are now a part and you now hold that sacred duty to impart those stories as honestly and as well as you possibly can.
May I ask who the figures were that loomed large at that time to sort of set a bit of a scene?
Look, you know, Barry Cassidy was on the scene then. There were most of them have passed. You see, most of them have gone. As you can imagine, that's 46 years ago. So in actual fact, only the young folk like me are still around from that period. But look, you know, our bureau chief at the time had. is on the wall at Parliament House in the class photo of 1945. Wow. So that's a hell of a continuity. That's only two generations, and you go from 1945, and he was a journalist before then, to me in 1921. At 2021, mm-hmm. and that's an incredible, longevity in just two generations. And I feel that sense of history, and I feel that sense of being a part of something far, far greater than myself.
Tell me about the Whitlam dismissal of 75.
Oh, well, that was a very dramatic moment. I wasn't a reporter then. I just started with the ABC, mm-hmm. and I was a camera assistant. And I was very politically aware in those days, mm-hmm. and very interested, and I rang up the office as soon as I heard what was going on, and I said, I'll come in. And they said, oh, no Ned, no, don't worry about it. I thought, you're joking. I was really cross, I was really angry. I said, and I hopped in my Volkswagen Beetle and tore down to Parliament House. But in a way it was good because I could be an observer. I didn't have to work. I was watching what was going on and seeing this incredible anger and this groundswell of a fury in the crowd that developed outside of Old Parliament House, because just Parliament House in those days. And you get, there's the famous Gough Whitlam speech on the Parliament House steps.
God save the Queen.
God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General. I remember one particular coalition senator and giving the finger to the crowd.
Oh, God.
And the crowd was all yelling, jump, 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 because it was a couple of stories up.
It was a very different time, wasn't it?
Very, very different time. But you can't underestimate the anger, the palpable anger that was in so many people's minds. Of course, there was the other side of Australia, thought it was great, that hated Whitlam, felt he'd run it into the ground financially, saw him, as a socialist threat to democracy. So it was two sides to that story. But in Canberra, very much a Labor town and has remained so, there was that very, very quick and very vociferous reaction to what was going on.
Mm. Well, they were very – the Whitlam dismissal was his whole government, if you look at the years before. It was a very turbulent 3 years.
It was very dramatic.
Yeah.
But, he did a lot of stuff, Medicare comes from him. Support for unmarried mothers comes from him. Mm. So many things were enacted in that short space of time. And don't forget, he faced three elections, lost the last one. So, yes, it was turbulent and very dramatic, made more so by this so-called Kemlani affair, which was an attempt by Rex Connor, who was the Minerals and Energy Minister, to buy back the farmers, he said, basically to buy all the resources in Australia, the natural resources, and invest them back into the Commonwealth so that all of Australians got the benefit from the iron ore or whatever it was that was being sold. But he went through a very dodgy kind of financier called Kemlani, and that, of course, was enormous fodder for the tabloids of the time and was the beginning of the end for the Whitlam government.
Sort of the final undoing.
Absolutely.
Well, you've done a number of very different roles in the ABC, including being a stagehand. It sounds like the day of the Whitlam dismissal, you were more of a photojournalist.
Well, kind of, but not on that day. No phones, of course, mobile phones in those days, so no actual photos from that day.
How did you make the move to journalism? Did you have a plan, or did journalism find you?
No, I was definitely after it.
Yeah.
But my view was get into the ABC or get in somewhere. And work it out after that, which is what I did. My first job was one day's work, and I was employed because of bad set design. It was a program called State of the Nation, and the set was too much to handle for one person. So Mike Neal, who was the staging chief, said he needed someone else, and I got that job. And, 46 years later, here I am. But I always intended to be a journalist. In the meantime, I became a sound recordist, a camera assistant under the great Peter DeVries, a cameraman, and became a film editor, which was a great discipline to learn. So in the end, I think it was great sort of 5 years learning the craft from beginning to end, and really giving myself, learning some skills that have been instrumental in my life ever since. But it was a local radio station that gave me the break, 2CC, God bless them. And I joined what was then a five journalists in the local newsroom. Can you believe it these days? You know, you're lucky if you get one, let alone five. But there was a very vibrant local radio scene then for news. Mm. And in the old Parliament House, when I started there, there were, I think, about 23 commercial news journalists. Now I think there'd be two or three. So that's been a very big and sad change. It was a really competitive, exciting time to be in Old Parliament House. But, you know, it still is, whoever you're working for. But unfortunately, those jobs have largely gone.
I was speaking with Glenn Daniel, who has had a very long and storied career within commercial radio mainly, but he, you know, talks about when being sent over to Rwanda in the mid-90s with Today FM to cover what was, you know, going on over there, the atrocities that were happening there. I mean, that would never happen today.
No.
Commercial radio stations would never send a foreign correspondent over.
Absolutely not.
Or wouldn't have one, really.
Wouldn't have one to go. No. And wouldn't, yeah, exactly. And that's sad, but that's the reality of where the money is now.
Mm.
Clearly, there was a lot more money in commercial radio in those days. So that's been a huge change. In fact, I was supposed to go on that trip too, with the Australian Army in one of their planes, and I had 8 jabs in one day and was ready to go the next day. Mark Colvin, the great departed Mark Colvin, could get in faster because he was based in London. So he was sent instead, and that shaped his life and ultimately shaped his demise, sadly,
of course, yeah.
Because he got very sick there, and it was a sickness that then cursed his life right up until the end. So, you know, these little sort of moments that...
sliding door moments.
Totally. That could have been me or not, maybe neither of us. You know, it's just one of those things that, especially if you go to these places where there are horrendous things happening, or there's, you know, a lot of disease prevalent or whatever, there are these dangers, and you know, really, really sadly, it just caught up with Mark.
Well, I want to definitely talk a little bit more about that and the downsides of working as a foreign correspondent. First of all, though, you've mentioned, you know, your start in regional radio and how much commercial stations have newsrooms have changed. Tell us about what you also learnt working in regional Australia.
Well, look, you know, the thing about regional Australia is you better be on your game.
Yeah.
You better be able to convince people that you're authentic and that you're not out to shaft them. And that's a skill that sticks with you, because, you know, I'm not saying that people in metropolitan areas can't pick a fraud, but they certainly can in the bush. And your ability to convince and guide and cajole in a gentle way those people and to tell their stories to you, that sticks with you forever. And that went on for me. I was with Countrywide, which was a current affairs program. It's kind of like Landline, but it had a better time slot.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked brilliantly for me later, because I learnt, don't be tricky here. You know, you've got to be straight and honest and, you know, tell it like it is and tell their stories honestly, or you're not going to get through the front door. So, you know, that was very, very helpful. I think you'll find a lot of the successful foreign correspondents and the camera people have come from regional areas.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing it teaches you is you have to be resourceful, because you have to do it all. You have to get out there, shoot it, cut it, present it, whatever it is. And I think that is a very, very useful skill to have as well.
How many years did you spend working in regional Australia?
Oh, well, I was on the road probably for about 6 years doing that,
mm-hmm.
and then had one very inglorious year. Well, it was glorious in one way, as in a holiday show.
Oh, right.
The holiday show with Geraldine Doogue, the great Geraldine Doogue.
The great Geraldine,
which is the first time I'd worked.
A good friend of Fourth Estate.
Oh, yes, a good friend and a good friend to journalism in Australia, because, you know, I think there is no person that's made a greater contribution to Australian journalism than Geraldine.
I think many would agree with you.
And, you know, not only that, but, you know, the warmth of her heart is just, you know, you can roast marshmallows with it.
I always say about Geraldine that she is exactly the same off air that she is on air, from my experience.
Which is incredibly effusive.
Uh-huh.
And
there's not many around like that.
No, and interested. I mean, usually, you know, when you reach a certain age, you get a bit jaded and a bit skeptical about life and people and things. And she treats everyone with great respect and the stories with great respect and with the enthusiasm as though mm-hmm. she's just come out of, you know, just come out of J school and this is her first job. And that's, you know, that's one of the many things I love about her.
Well, I think the other thing that really comes across about Geraldine is her curiosity, as you've just mentioned. How important do you think curiosity plays into journalism? Do you think there's a lot of journos out there that they approach something, their mind made up?
I think you have to be a curious cat to be in this business. It's really, really vital. You have to genuinely like people, mm-hmm. I think, because, you know, I just think it helps to get people interested in telling their stories. But curiosity is a baseline mm-hmm. for this business. If you're not a very curious person, maybe look at doing something else because this is not the job for you. And also flexible. You have to be flexible because you might think you're on a particular story bent or a process and something else comes up. You can't just stick to that, the path you were going to go. You have to be flexible to shift gear. And you might see something or just hear something that's different and it takes you in a different direction. You've got to be able to do that. And especially with interviewing. When you're interviewing, you've got your questions. Yeah, you've got your set questions. You can't just rely on those alone. You have to listen to what's being said, like you're listening to me now, because there'll be things maybe that people say that take you in a completely different direction. Unexpected direction.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's good to sometimes step away from the notes and go with.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I'm doing an interview, I will have just topic things that I want to cross. Now, how I get there or whatever is completely fluid, and I want to tick them off, but mainly I want to listen, hear what's said, and then spark my next question from that, usually. Usually. I don't always succeed, you know. I've had my duds, believe me.
Well, I mean, there's certain people that make it very clear you need to stick to your questions.
That's true.
That don't encourage great... absolutely.
No.
Okay, so you started at the ABC as a stagehand and then became a news journo, but how did you make the jump to being a foreign correspondent?
Look, very easily because it was my passion. You know, this is where I wanted to be. When my parents gave me at about age 9 or 10 this little tiny little recorder. It was before cassettes. It was little tape to tape thing. Had 2.5 minutes that used to run in it, and I used to do fake reports. Often they were from foreign places. You know, I was emulating what I was hearing on the radio from ABC reporters.
Right.
We didn't have TV where I was in those days.
Where did you grow up? Can I ask?
Armidale in northern New South Wales.
Right.
First 10 years, and mm-hmm. then we moved to Canberra. So, mm-hmm. I just had that hunger to do that from a very, very young age and, you know, finally got there and it was all and better than I expected, you know, I'd hoped for. Not always easy, you know, really, really tough times and, you know, tough emotionally and times when, you know, it did overwhelm me. But the privilege to be able to tell your people, your, you know, tribe, as I like to call it, what you're seeing and interpret that and see it through Australian eyes for them is just something very precious indeed. And, you know, I've just had the most wonderful privilege to be able to do that for so long.
What was your first assignment?
It would have been in Japan.
Right.
And because my first one was Tokyo in 1990. But in those days, Tokyo occupied the space that China does in the Australian psyche now. It was the big beast in the world. It was the economy was going gangbusters.
Mm-hmm.
People were a little afraid, I think, of the Japanese people because they seemed to be superhuman in the productivity and the amount of money.
Japan was going to take over the world at that time.
Totally. Yeah. And then that, you know, fizzled away. And now that's China occupies that space. But, you know, there was a huge appetite in Australia for anything about Japan. So I had no trouble selling my stories back to Australia at that time.
How did that assignment come up? How did that posting come up?
The competitive process. Trevor Borman, the great Trevor Borman, was my competitor. I was with the 7:30 Report. Mm-hmm. He was with News. News didn't want me. 7:30 didn't want him. So at the end, we had a job off. We had to swap jobs and see who won. Anyway, I did actually win that, but then he shortly after got the Middle East. So we both ended up as foreign correspondents.
So you start in 1990, as we've already established, in Tokyo, but fairly early on as a foreign correspondent, you had a very scary moment. I'm thinking of Seoul in 1992.
Yes.
When you were covering the riots.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, very intense riots, you know, several hundred thousand people involved in these pitched battles between mainly students and workers and the police. And there were ideological battles, left, right, that sort of thing. But very violent. But with that violence, and we're talking petrol bombs and iron bars, there was never supposed to be a death. No, there was a kind of a unwritten law. You could injure someone, but you couldn't kill them. Anyway, a student was killed by the police, and there was a funeral held for this unfortunate person. And we were in the middle of a procession, a couple of hundred thousand people, and it came to a pinch point under a railway bridge. And as we were about to go under that, we had made a very bad strategic error, and we'd placed ourselves in the middle of that crowd, not on the edge. And the danger is, of course, if something goes bad, you're too far from being able to get away from it. So somebody, a poor woman, doused herself with lighter fluid, set herself alight on the railway bridge and jumped into that crowd, just about two or three people in front of us, and she died. Now, the crowd was already highly emotional, and all they saw was a foreign film crew. We were foreigners. We must have been responsible in some way. This has happened right there, then and there. And they started to lay into us, started to beat us up. And I thought, well, we all thought, we might not get out of this because we were 20 deep either side. Luckily for us, we were right at a medical school, was right at that spot. And the medical students, in fact, formed a flying wedge and got the poor girl out. Unfortunately, they couldn't save her. And then they did the same for us. And we were being punched and kicked and whatever on the way out. But they got us out. And, you know, the worst we ended up with were the bruises and the scratches and whatever. I think it could have been a whole lot worse. But what it taught me was a couple of things. Your physical the way you place yourself is very, very important. And you always need an escape plan. And the second is be very wary of crowds. And I still am, because they're often poorly led by the biggest idiot that happens to be in the room. And they can do irrational things. And that's why, you know, to this day, I actually don't like being in crowds.
1992, there was no mindfulness, or there was at least, you know, very little awareness of PTSD.
None at all. I don't think it had been defined at that point, Frank
really?
Ockberg.
Really? It wasn't even a...
Okay. I don't think it had been officially defined by Frank Ockberg. Yep.
How did you get yourself back together, and what was it like being back on the road after something like that?
That was not so difficult in a sense that it was a physical assault. We got over it and we were okay. And the expectation in those days was you just get on with it. You know, there's... you've been through something, you're not hurt, you get back on that horse. And we did, and that was okay. There are other events that happened later, like the Beslan, which was the attack on the school with all the school kids were killed by a terrorist attack in southern Russia, and I was there with others from the ABC.
Do you remember the year of that? I can...
It was that would have been 2004.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can remember that event. It was
it's a shocking
horrific event.
Yeah. It's just a shocking event. Yeah. And we were there, and you know, we saw the results, and we're there with the shooting. It was that perfect storm of a horrendous story involving children, and you yourself are in physical danger because there are bullets and bombs flying. And that's the perfect storm for a PTSD event, and that's what happened to me. And I didn't know I had it. I was only vaguely aware of it. Didn't think it applied to me, but my family made me aware that I was a changed person. I knew I was changed, but they made me aware. And from that moment, we could sort of get together and start to repair things, which happened luckily because, you know, I didn't want my career defined by that moment. I didn't want it stopped by that moment. And, you know, luckily for me, it hasn't been.
And luckily for the rest of us. Now, your first posting to Europe was in 2001?
Yeah, that's right. Beginning of 2001 to London.
To London?
Yep. And again, you know, how lucky was I? You know, it was just a fantastic time to be in Europe.
Yeah.
With so much change, the Iraq War happened.
Well, I was about to say 9/11. You were in London 9/11, during that time?
Yeah, 9/11 happened and I was in London and the first thing I did, I always carried my passport. So I just, no clothes, or I just had my kit, my radio gear and whatever, and hopped in a cab and went straight out to the airport to Heathrow.
Right.
And tried to catch a plane to the States. Well, by then the airspace was shut down. Mm-hmm. I'd heard there was a plane being rented by a couple of the big British broadcasters, and I at another airport went there. Anyway, I think I did 7 trips to the airport before we finally actually got there via Montreal.
Right.
4 days later. But yes, I got to report that major event, and that was, that's still surreal for me. I still have not got my head quite around that, even though, you know, I saw it all. I saw the evidence. I saw the hole. I saw the, it was still, you know, fires and spoke to many people about it, but it just all seems like a weird dream to me. And some, you know, some stories just stick with you in that way.
It's funny how that story, I think, sticks with a lot of people, and 3,000 dead is horrific, absolutely, no doubt, no question. The way it happened, it was also appalling. It's funny to note, though, that, you know, many more die in many other wars and in many other, you know, horrific, all around the world each day. Yet that is something, and it stays with me. It was a huge news event, obviously. It's something that definitely, I think there was something about that story that shaped and changed the world.
It certainly did, and meant, you know, it flowed from that, of course, Afghanistan, which we're just now pulling out of. And, of course, that doesn't change the situation for the Afghanis. It, you know, there is a more terrible days ahead, I fear, for that country. So that's unresolved. You know, the Iraq War was, you know, not entirely separated from that as well. So a lot happened because of that particular attack. And you know, I remember going out to the airport and listening to a shock jock on one of the London radio stations saying, "This is going to change the face of Western civilization." And I was thinking, "Oh, God, what a load of rubbish." Mm. And you know what? He was right, in a sense. He really was right. It did change, you know, the West's relationship with the world. It created a lot more conflict and still unresolved conflicts going on. So, you know, it was, even though, as you rightly say, it wasn't in itself the biggest loss of life or whatever, it did have that dramatic effect because this is the United States you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, this is the most powerful military country in the world. And they were not going to sit back and not do anything.
No.
And, you know, the domino effect of all those of the things that came after that are still echoing now, and people are still dying now.
Mm. I think, as you say, the repercussions, I think, because of which country it was that was attacked, had a big part to play. I also think, again, because of it was the United States, and they've really seeped into Western culture, and
absolutely,
it's such a part
and
of
we're so aligned, and we identify so much with the States,
and those
so
images,
much of our culture comes from the United States,
And those images were just
incredibly powerful.
Yeah.
Incredibly powerful. You know, you think now of those pictures of the planes going in, it looks like a B-grade movie. You know, it looks like something that's been done on a green screen. You know, it just doesn't look real. But, it was.
I still get chills
absolutely.
Watching it, to be
absolutely.
Honest.
Absolutely. Yeah. Me too. Yeah. Me too. That never changes.
No.
Yeah. But look, you know, going back to what you said before, it really does matter where you die and how you die as to whether you get recognition or support or whatever. I covered the earthquake in Haiti.
Right.
Now, that was a terrible, terrible event. Up to 300,000 people died in that shocking, apocalyptic occasion. And, certainly there was aid came in, and there was certainly a lot of international attention, but not now. No one cares about the families that were shattered by that event, or the poverty that's still created by that event, or the people still are homeless because of that event. If that same thing had happened at that scale, to a major city in Europe or the US or Australia, we would still be on it. We would still be caring. So, yeah, I'm afraid there is this sort of order of importance to who you are and why and how you died that seems to contribute to how people feel about it or remember it or don't remember it or care or don't care years later.
When you're covering an event like the earthquake in Haiti, does that make you even more determined to cover it in a way or give it the platform that it so rightly deserves and to make the world really sit up and pay attention?
Yeah, absolutely, because you may be one of a few organisations that are actually telling the world what's happening here and why they should care and why they should, put a few bucks into that appeal, which does materially then affect the outcomes for the victims of those crises. Huge responsibility. I've always felt that. I remember going into a place called Ormoc in the southern Philippines, and it was my first experience of mass death, and there were thousands of people in this city killed within a couple of minutes by a flash flood. And everywhere you went, there were bodies, there were people digging for their relatives. There were horrendous sights. And every time the tide came in, there would be a tide of bodies that would be left on the beach. It was really confronting stuff. But no many had been there. They didn't identify with that place. They didn't identify with those people. So you have this great responsibility to tell people just how bad it is and bring that humanity home. Because in the end, we are all equally human. We have that same, desire for security and food and shelter and all those basics that we take for granted, but in those situations isn't necessarily there, that the help isn't necessarily there, because nations like in the Philippines, especially in those days, didn't have the resources necessarily to put into rescuing everyone and helping everyone at that time. So yeah, it's a definite responsibility. It's one I feel very strongly, and I'm sure it's one I've failed on many occasions, but I still have that desire to do it.
Returning a little bit to you did two postings to London as a
yep.
foreign correspondent, as a Europe correspondent.
Yep.
So from 2001 to 2005, and then it was
2008 to the end of 15. So yeah, so 12 years all up. It's a pretty good run.
Very good run, and very interesting years in Europe. What
yep.
did you? I mean, you arrived. It was Tony Blair. It was New Labour.
Yep.
Obviously, because of 9/11 and the years that followed, Europe, especially the UK, was very much gripped with terrorism and fighting terrorism.
Yeah, and that was very much dominated. It had been towards the end of my first posting as well. We'd had very serious terrorist attacks in Spain, for example,
right.
on the trains in Spain, 200 people killed there, which I covered extensively. But yeah, it was really winding. It was really starting to ratchet up in Europe,
right.
and of course, you had later on you had the Syrian war,
mm-hmm.
which then forced mass migration
mm-hmm.
from Syria, Turkey, and then into Europe, and which is something you never expect to see in your life. It was how I imagined post Second World War Europe was, where you had people displaced all over Europe and no means of getting home other than walking. And so you were witness to literally thousands and thousands of people just walking past you in these long lines, trying to search for those, fundamentals of life, security, food, shelter, and a better life and a better future for them and their kids. That was a very profoundly moving experience. And some of the people you met along the way were so humbling. You know, I remember stopping a guy and he came up to me, actually. We were filming. He said, "Where am I?" I said, "You're in Hungary." And he said, "Oh, really? I didn't know." He said, "Yes, it's about 100 metres down that railway line." They were following railway lines. And I asked him about where he'd come from. And he'd been from a wealthy family in Syria. But they'd pretty much lost everything. And I said, what have you got? And he said, "Don't make me cry." And he just opened his plastic bag and there was a bottle of water and a packet of biscuits. And that's what that guy had in his life. That's what he'd... And he was just looking for a decent, secure life there. Now, that pause is because I was caught. It took me back in the moment. So you see, these things never quite leave you. You know, they're with you. They're your children, good and bad. And occasionally they'll rise and bite you, or just remind you. But I'm not afraid of that. I'm not afraid of the emotion that comes with the consequences of the work. I think I'd be far more worried and far more afraid if I felt nothing. I think having that reaction is a good human reaction, and I'm glad for it.
I think it's a great driver for many of the great foreign correspondents. It's what gets them out of bed every day. One person's story that really grabs me was that of Marie Colvin's.
And, oh, yes. You know, I had the privilege of meeting her once.
Really?
Yeah,
Tell us about that.
Well, we were on a chemical weapons course just before the Iraq War at a place called Salisbury. It was an army base. And
So this is after she'd been blinded?
Yes. She'd been blinded in one eye.
Yeah.
And she'd only recently returned after a lot of rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And so there was this woman, formidable woman, with the eye patch. And I tried to engage her about that and her past. She wouldn't have a bar of it. She did not want to go there, and I just backed right off straight away. And then, of course, you know, she was an incredible person, an incredibly courageous person that went into the most dangerous situations.
Situations, went in furthest, frankly, and stayed the longest.
Frankly... places I would not have gone myself. I did not have the courage to do that. And then paid that horrendous price where it appears she was deliberately targeted along with others. But look, there's a very big difference between her and me. The very big difference is that she was a war correspondent. She defined herself that way. Mm-hmm. That's what she did. I'm not. I was a correspondent that occasionally covered wars, and there's a very big difference. I didn't seek that out. I didn't enjoy it in particular. Of course, if it came to it, I did the job. But she was a very, very special, one-of-a-kind person who, again, never lost her sense of humanity, never lost the focus of what it was all about, always spoke of not just the strategic and the shifting sands, but always focusing on the people who were suffering. And boy, was she in the thick of it, you know, especially in those last few weeks in Syria.
It seemed to be her driving force, the actual humanity behind the story, and that is what I think made her work so remarkable. And she actually did, in some ways, change the world, and she changed outcomes because of her reporting.
Yes, that's right. And that shows the absolute power of that type of reporting and getting in there and bearing witness to the worst. But, you know, it can come at a terrible cost, personal cost. And that's not just a cost for you, it's a cost for your family.
Well, I was going to ask about that. I think you've obviously pointed out that you're not a war correspondent, you're a foreign correspondent, and you've spoken of the differences between the two, but you've still gotten yourself into some pretty dicey situations.
Yep.
You're a family man with a deep well of empathy. What made you get on a plane each time and leave friends and families behind?
Well, fortunately, my wife was a journalist,
helpful.
That helped enormously. She completely understood the sort of pressures and why I did what I did. Mm-hmm. I think I've seen, you know, enormous pressures on marriages where that hasn't been understood. So I was very, very lucky. And my kids, grew up with it. So it was just normal that Dad wouldn't be there for your birthday, or would be, or they didn't understand, you know, exactly what I was doing a lot of the time. I didn't go into detail about some of the dicey situations. I didn't want to worry them and scare them, as that was pointless. And you know, not even I didn't always tell my wife everything, you know, either. And funny stories though, when you think about that, in Beslan, at the height of the shooting and the bombings going on in Beslan, I thought, oh, my wife will be listening. Well, she'll hear this on the news and she'll be terribly worried about me. I'll give her a quick call to reassure her I'm okay. And I gave her the call. She answered and she said, I can't talk now. I've lost my parking ticket, and hung up. So there's always the perspective, you know.
Yeah.
There's always other life going on somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that can be hard too. You know, you go to a place like Iraq or Afghanistan or wherever. I've only been to Afghanistan very briefly. You go home. That can be really hard because no one actually cares that much about, you know, the stories that you've been totally engrossed in. They don't care that there's been a change of defence minister and that's had this effect and that effect in some country they'd never heard of. Life just goes on, and that can be very difficult to accept. But at some point, you just got to say, well, that is a different reality, and you know, and not be angry with them because they don't care, or they're not passionate about the same things that you are. But it can be difficult when you come back and you know you slip into the more mundane, what we'd consider mundane stories. But, you know, that's just the way it is, and you just have to come to an acceptance of that.
Let's move to the US. The last 4 years have really torn that country to pieces. What did you see during your time there, and are you optimistic about the next 4 years?
Ah, this is a very difficult one. Depends when you ask.
Because you moved to the US beginning of 16, was it?
Well, I was there for the election.
Right.
So I was there for the election, and then I was there for 7.5 months last year.
Right.
And that was for the election, but also it turned out to be for COVID and for Black Lives Matter and all the other stories that occurred.
Extraordinary, yeah.
Yeah, 2020 extraordinary. For, now, look, I was an exchange student in America in 1974.
Right.
When I was 17. And what I saw then was a country that had, you know, Republican, Democrat, but it didn't define who you liked or who you associated with. Mm. Now it does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now it's kind of rare to have a Republican cohort with Democrat friends. It's so divided, and that's terribly sad for me, because the country has lost its cohesiveness. I think it's lost its focus, and I don't. Up until very recently, I was very pessimistic about the country. But I'm just hoping that Biden can do enough things that at least a fair percentage of the country think are okay and good for the country, that they'll think, okay, we are one country, or they can see that they are one country. But, you know, if you talk to some really, you know, hardcore followers of Trump, and I spoke to many of them, it's hard to imagine them ever accepting, A, that he isn't the president or shouldn't be the president, and B, that Biden is anything other than the devil incarnate destined to destroy the nation.
Yes, with socialism or communism.
With socialism, you know, such, you know, incredibly radical policies like medicine for the poor and this sort of thing. Stuff that we take for granted here in Australia, which is regarded as rampant, you know, communism there. Mm. You know, I often got asked the question by Trump supporters, oh, do you have socialist medicine in Australia?
Socialist medicine?
Socialist medicine. Wow. And in their context, yes, we do. You know, we have a support system. We have a network.
I have no idea
there.
That's what I've been taking whenever I've been unwell.
Oh, yes, that's right. You've been
well, that
supported
explains
by the yeah, that's right. Exactly. You've been receiving communist largesse in the bucketful.
That's why my brother's a Marxist.
That's it. Maybe that's it. Yeah, we're all Marxists in Australia.
Yes.
But yeah, things that we take for granted that we think are pretty normal sort of supports,
yes,
you know, don't necessarily exist. And you'd be surprised at how many people in America think they shouldn't exist, and you know, see that as the thin edge or the thick edge of the wedge, that's going to, you know, designed for a communist takeover or whatever. I mean, there are some very wacky theories out there, expounded by very decent, nice, intelligent people who just happen to have formed these views, you know, partly fueled by social media, partly fueled by fake news, as they say, but also just by that distrust, that fundamental distrust of the other, and the other being the Democrats or non-Republicans. And that's very sad to see because, you know, it's a great country. US, you know, I know people don't, it's not very fashionable necessarily to say this, but that is, the US is a fabulous, great country, and it's got a lot of very decent, intelligent and warm-hearted people who, you know, just at the moment have lost their way, and I just hope they find it.
In viewing Trump's first 100 days in office, how do you view Biden's first 100 days in office, you know, side by side? Does either give you hope?
Well, look, you know, it depends. If you're a Trump supporter, you'd say what he did was fantastic and, you know, effectively banning Muslim-majority countries' citizens from coming to the States.
He pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord,
Pulled out of that.
Fired a lot of people.
Yeah, fired a lot of people. You know, that's a prerogative, you know, not entirely surprising. And then you look at Biden and what he's been doing at a very fast rate. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he's probably got the old 100 days, you know, fixed in his mind.
Yeah.
That's goes in the history books.
He must recite that
that's right.
Each day.
Exactly, yeah. What 10 things can we do today?
Yeah.
But, yeah, look, you could not get a more different approach, more different, you know, coming from a different philosophy. And it's assumed, I think, by many now that Trumpism is dead. It's not. It's just having a little rest. And the Trump supporters are still there in their millions, tens of millions, and it could reemerge again, and that could be Trump himself or one of his relatives.
In another form.
And, you know, it's we could be back there again. And, you know, some people watching, listening to this program will say, well, that'd be great, and I look forward to that day. Mm-hmm. And many others, maybe not so much.
I was saying to someone the other day that he's been very quiet. Like, I haven't had to type his name very often. I work in news as well, and I haven't had to type his name recently. I haven't spoken his name very much at all. But what concerns me about that is, I don't know if you've ever been around quite naughty, mischievous children.
I've had them.
You've had them? Great. I'm sure. Well, then, of course, you have. And have you ever put them in a room and they've been very quiet for a really long period of time?
You get very concerned. Yeah. What's going on? Yeah. They're up to something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And look,
in a sense, there's no great hurry. You see, he still is the kingmaker. Mm. He can still determine whether a congressman, you know, gets endorsed or not, or a senator. And so he still has enormous power, you know, even if some of the party now have disassociated themselves. Yeah. He's still got enough to determine the general direction of the party. And he's quiet at the moment, but this is, you know, this is the calm before the Trump storm. And of course, he hasn't got his social media accounts. That's been an enormous problem for him. But he's not in campaign mode. It's too early.
And as you said, it might not be in his, you know, in the form of Trump, but I think the public dialogue that he gave such voice to, I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon.
No, not at all.
No.
And, you know, we're talking about a lot of evangelical Christians in particular, and the issue, the one issue that really gave him a lot of supporters was abortion.
Yeah.
It's an issue that is so powerful and so contentious in the States in a way that it's just not here in Australia. It's not necessarily a totally settled issue here, but it's not front and centre of people's minds. It is for many Americans. And when he came out as pro-life, that actually attracted a lot of support, especially from religious groups as well. You know, people that may not be attracted necessarily to his own sense of, you know, personal morals or whatever along the way. But that one issue has brought him a lot of support. And he's hoping, of course, that that ends up Roe versus Wade gets tested in the Supreme Court, which is now, of course, thanks to him, has two more members that are very deeply conservative, and you know, he hopes, and those that from the religious right that supported him would hope, you know, carry through with those promises.
Speaking of another world leader with very famous hair, you, with all the years that you spent in London, were you perplexed or surprised by the rise and fall and rise again of the once mayor, Boris Johnson?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I actually I've interviewed him. I did a story on him for a foreign correspondent. And look, he's an act, you know. He's an act that is where his act is running a little out of steam.
Mm-hmm.
He's in a bit of trouble at the moment over the refurb of number 10 Downing Street.
Mm.
Did it come out of his pocket or did it come out of other pockets? He is very funny. You know, he at his best, he's a very witty and entertaining guy. But does that necessarily make him a good prime minister? You know, that's I guess, a question that Britain answered very emphatically at the last election. Yes, it does. But I just wonder when it really hits the fan whether he's going to stand and be the one that the public says, yeah, he can pull us through this, whatever it is, and whether they still believe him. I think there's a sort of question mark about his authenticity and a question mark about his believability.
How destabilising do you think, there's a very important election coming up in Europe, that of the German election. Chancellor Angela Merkel is stepping down after 16 years in the job. And there's talk that for the first time there might be a German Greens government elected. How do you think that the next German election, how important do you think it'll be to the rest of Europe? Can you see it being a destabilising force or one that actually really brings the continent together in a way that it's clearly crying out for at the moment?
Well, in some ways, you know, you can't have the passing of the mother and have the family still stay as it is. You know, Angela Merkel has, whether you like her or not, she's been an incredibly strong rock and someone that has been pretty consistent all the way through.
Mm.
In her beliefs and in her actions. And I think she will leave a huge hole. Now, how that vacuum is filled is going to be really interesting to see. You've got, possibly Macron in trouble in France with, you know.
Some remarkable developments over there.
Yeah, exactly, with, you know, Le Pen on the rise there too. And you know, a possible president.
One of his ministers, the recent exchange between him and Marine Le Pen.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. So you've got some real changing of the guards there, potentially, and a remaking of the map. You've got very right-wing governments in Hungary, in Poland, and it'd be interesting to see if that spreads further. At the same time, you know, people kind of forget this, but you've got a lot of pressure from Russia on Europe and on NATO in particular, and you know that could erupt in ways that we can't foresee at the moment, either in the Baltic states or in Ukraine, where there is actually a low level but still hot war going on. There are all sorts of pressures in Europe that can reshape the political geography there. And I think it's too difficult to predict how that would work itself out and how that would change things. But clearly, with Britain out of the EU, that weakens that institution. If you'd had, you know, a very strong Britain and standing very strongly with Europe, I think that presents a pretty formidable block of political will. If that's dissipated, then those that are, you know, not big fans of the EU or not big fans of NATO might find opportunity to erode that power. The world is undergoing such rapid change, and China plays such a huge role in that change and in our futures,
mm-hmm.
In ways, again, that we can't really predict at the moment. and possibly in not great ways. Who knows? I do fear for the security of our region.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are, you know, this big power pressure may come to a head at some point, at some place, you know, possibly Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that talk of, you know, the beating drums and whatever that we heard is turns out to be overstated. But, you know, you've got big nations, big egos, a lot at stake, and we're kind of almost bystanders here. I mean, we don't have a lot of economic or military power, but we will feel the consequences in a very big and deep way if things go south between especially the US and China.
Well, traveling the world, you must have a very unique experience of what Australia actually is. What do you think are Australia's unique strengths, and what do you think are our weaknesses?
Well, as a nation, I mean, traditionally we've actually had a pretty good presence on the world stage,
mm-hmm.
With human rights and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're probably not as strong in those areas as we have been in the mm-hmm. past, and we've been a little bit more inward focused than we have in the past. And I don't say that as any criticism of any particular government,
mm-hmm.
but I just think as a nation we're more interested in ourselves than those outside at the moment. We're still obviously a big player in our own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's competition there too.
Mm.
There's competition for influence and space with countries that, you know, we traditionally seen ourselves as the big brother, with Papua New Guinea and, you know, in the Pacific. So that's potentially changing too. So I don't think, as a nation, we can just sit back and expect things to just roll on as normal. I fear that there'll be change, but I don't know in what way, and I'm a bit worried it won't be in a very positive way. But I hope I'm wrong.
Let's end on two big questions. So 40 plus years at the ABC,
yes.
You must have very strong views on its place in the Australian media. What is important to you about the ABC, and why do you think it's under attack?
Well, I think it plays a pivotal role in the health of the nation's democracy, in the question that was posed by the Democrats early in the mm-hmm. piece of keeping the bastards honest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not popular with any government. We were never popular with a Labor government when they're in power. Why? Because we question what they do. We delve into what they do, more so than when you're in opposition, because you're not as relevant. You're not making those decisions that beg the questions. So there's nothing new in that.
I think I remember Geraldine Doogue saying that I think Bob Hawke wanted her sacked after her coverage of the Gulf War in 1991.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, he was furious, absolutely furious.
Yeah.
Now, who would ever sack Geraldine Doogue? I mean, that should be a national crime.
Yes, I agree. I agree, Phil, I agree.
Look, the ABC has always been under pressure in some way or another. I think when I joined, there were about 5,000 people. I think there are at least 1,000 less than that. And, you know, this is 46 years later.
Mm-hmm.
You'd expect it to grow. Certainly what we do has grown exponentially. What individual journalists do is in one day is nothing short of miraculous. Mm-hmm. I think if people really understood how hard ABC and, of course, other journalists in commercial world as well, how hard they actually work and how diligent and honest they are, they might have a different view of the ABC. It's very easy to say, it's full of lefties and they're all lying and all the rest of it. That's, to be honest, is crap. I've been there. I know the people. I know how much they care about accuracy and balance. And, if the ABC were to go, we would lose more than we could imagine in our national life. And so, you know, if it ever really comes down to the wire, I hope your listeners are at the barricades. I will be, because I'm free to do that now as an ex-ABC employee. It's a beautiful institution to be protected.
Lastly, Australia during the COVID pandemic has become a very inward-looking and insular nation. What lessons from your time travelling the world do you think Australians would be wise to follow?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I just think that Australians need to remember, and this sounds a bit preachy, but they just need to remember they're part of a bigger story, the story of global humanity, and that in any way that we can help others lift themselves out of whatever hole they're in, we should attempt to do it. I'm not saying give up everything, throw all our money overseas, but just be mindful, you know, where there are humans in need, we have a responsibility as fellow humans to try and help.
Phil Williams, it has been a great, great honour. Thank you so much for joining us in Fourth Estate, and thank you for all you have done for the Fourth Estate
journalism. Thank you so much, and thanks to the listeners and everyone that have been so kind on my retirement, saying nice things. A couple of people saying they wished I was going to die a horrible death, but, you know, not many.
Well, that's good.
That's good.
They were in the minority.
they're in the minority. I think there's only sort of 46% said that. No, it's been a wonderful privilege, a great ride, and I'm incredibly grateful both to the ABC and very specifically to the Australian people who funded it all.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Thank you again, Phil.
Thanks.
And thank you for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, of course, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. Many thanks as always to my executive producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Tina Quinn. You can catch us next week on Fourth Estate.